You're listening to Audio Culture on 95 BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Let's wait for that. Let's hold off.
Nice.
We've got it on vinyl. Welcome to the BFM studio. It's kind of a fairly standard classic BFM entry into a live situation, hitting next on the button before we get into it. But welcome, Russell Brown. We've got you in studio because we are talking about straitjacket fits in an article, a piece that you wrote for Rip It Up.
For Rip It Up in 1989, and Audio Culture has just recently republished it. Which was really nice because I hadn't actually read it since then. So it was kind of a revelation to me as well.
Now, what were you doing in Europe at the time? And was it around the fall of the Berlin Wall?
Yeah. I was living in London and working by that time as a music journalist for Sounds and Select and a few others. Mm-hmm. And we'd see our friends in New Zealand bands come through, and that would be nice. And we saw Straitjacket Fits come through, and they were on a tour where everything was going right for them musically. Mm-hmm. They'd been from the US, and they had a very eventful US tour because they were in San Francisco for the 1989 earthquake. Then they were in Los Angeles, and some crazy person dropped a block of concrete off a overpass onto their van. Everyone was all right. But then the main thing is they went to New York and played CMJ, the mm-hmm. College Music Journal Conference, which at the time, still is, but even more so at the time, was the place that you really needed to impress if you were going to do anything as a band. And they played what Shane said to me later, thought was probably the best gig they'd ever played. Wow. They tore the roof off. So then they land in London, and they're still playing really well. And somehow I'd agreed with Chris Burke, who was editing Rip It Up at that point, that it would be interesting to catch up with them in Berlin. Mm-hmm. because November 9th that year, 1989, the Brandenburg Gate opened. And that it's hard to explain how significant it was, because there had been this structure to the world that we'd all grown up with. Mm-hmm. This was how the world was divided up. And all of a sudden it was different. And it seemed incredibly optimistic. You know, it seemed really like, wow, things are going to change now. Mm-hmm. Because these people have gotten their way, and they are, you know, they are no longer controlled by these authoritarian leaders. Mm-hmm. And they can actually cross what used to be an impenetrable wall that people were shot for trying to get across. Mm-hmm. And move into the other side of their city. Because West Berlin back then was this geopolitical oddity. It was right in the middle of East Germany and could only be accessed by a long road called the Corridor, mm-hmm. or by air. And that was a result of a stalemate at the end of World War II. And dividing East and West Berlin was the Berlin Wall. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it wasn't. And that was extraordinary. So
was there a sense that it would become the creative mecca that it is today?
It kind of was already. Mm. Like Nick Cave and Blixer Bargeld were hanging out there, and because it was so isolated, it became this bohemian enclave. Mm-hmm. Because normal people didn't always want to live there, and it was actually interesting when I got there. I discovered that, and this is 3 weeks after the Brandenburg Gate opened, that some of the locals were coming to terms with the fact that it wasn't going to be quite as nice anymore. Mm-hmm. They were having to queue for things. There wasn't parking, mm-hmm. just because there were more people. Mm. Yeah, and it was actually fascinating. Before I even met up with the band, I just wandered around town.
What was it like? I mean, did they... Obviously, they booked the show there, but what are their expectations playing a place like that at that time?
It was a place on the circuit, and the place where they played Club Ecstasy was in the film Wings of Desire. You know, it was a reasonably well-known place. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like it was cut off, but it was an enclave. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden the locals were, you know, beginning to realise that actually this nice place where there was lots of space for everyone and lots of cheap housing and squats and things, that was changing too.
Mm-hmm.
Because you'd see, at that point, 3 weeks on, the West German government was still giving Easties 100 Deutschmarks at the border.
Mm-hmm.
To go and spend, because it would be ridiculous if they came across and just basically had to look in shop windows and look in bars.
Yes.
And that was quite, it was quite strange. I mean, that first day, a couple from East Berlin walked into the bar and everyone knew who they were because they looked different.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't look like they had the same nutrition. Basically.
It's funny you say that because you know, obviously I had a quick rip through your article on audio culture. There was like a certain look of being slightly malnourished,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's crazy to think of, you know. But I guess it was the case.
But I mean, on the other hand, they might not have looked so out of place in a city suburb in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But compared to the well-fed, shining West Germans around mm-hmm. them,
yes,
and all the wealth around them, because it was a wealthy place,
mm-hmm.
it really was quite stark.
Yes,
you know, and they almost looked like they weren't sure whether they were meant to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, of course, already they'd started bringing stuff over the border to sell so they could get hard currency. You know, mm-hmm. everything was changing.
Mm. Now, Russell, The purpose this evening is to talk about the article, but also for you to play some music. We have got something lined up on the turntables. We're going to play that.
Oh yeah. I sort of thought I'd go for things that reminded me of the era. This is World Domination Enterprises, who are a great little three piece. Who I saw quite a few times through the squatter circuit. And this is their extremely noisy cover of LL Cool J's I Can't Live Without My Radio.
And you've got this. This is obviously still an original pressing. It's got the UK price.
£3.49, yeah. I think I was actually working at the Virgin store at the time, so.
Maybe got a bit of a discount?
Yeah.
Here we go.
Motivated by the funky groove, I make a whoop of the wall up and it Kick your arms stunting. My radio's a line up to keep you crying. Shaking down, boogie down and rock. As you become motivated by my musical plot and to expand my musical plan. Dominator, rock the beat with your hand. Beat with your rock the beat, rock beat, rock the beat, 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 rock beat, beat, rock beat, rock the beat, 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 rock the beat, rock beat, rock the beat, 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 rock beat, beat with your hand. Keeping you on the go, but I just can't live without my radio.
World Domination Enterprises, I Can't Live Without My Radio.
And it's really nice to hear that on the radio, actually. Still love that record.
Played off a 12-inch that you acquired in the UK.
Yes, £3.49 from the Virgin store, where I worked, actually. So
around the time that you were a music journo in the UK.
Yeah.
But also heading out to faraway places like Berlin to report on Straitjacket Fits for NZ Media. How did that work at the time? How do you get in touch with New Zealand and say, look, I'm keen to do a story on Straitjacket Fits? How do you send back a story?
I'm so glad you asked me that, because I don't know. I mean, you look back, how do we ever do a bunch of things that we actually did without the internet? I don't understand it. I mean, how did, like, living in London and living quite a long way apart, how do we ever meet?
Yes.
I don't understand that, because people didn't even have phones in their homes. and this story, I guess I must have read The Guardian pretty closely, because there's a few musings on geopolitics that read all right, but, you know, it wasn't like I could go online and do it. But the main thing is, the gig that Straitjacket Fits played in Berlin was on December 1st.
Mm.
And somehow I got back from Berlin and wrote and filed the story in time for the December issue of Rip It Up.
What?
I don't understand it. I don't know how this happened. I presume it was faxed.
Okay.
But I have no memory of doing it, but it turned up.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it is that thing of it's hard to imagine how we did this stuff. You know, how do we know anything before the internet? but yeah, we did. You know,
the original piece is up on Audio Culture. I mean, what was it like at the time? I mean, did you obviously sat down with Straitjacket Fits and got a bit of a recap on the US tour?
Yeah, sat down with Shane, and he was feeling it as well. You know, and Shane, you know, sort of he does his best to be cynical and skeptical, but even he was, you know, feeling the love, because it really seemed like, hang on, the world's going to change and the 1990s are actually going to be a good place.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't quite turn out that way, but at the time it felt that way. I mean, it was just under 2 months after the wall fell, Mandela walked free.
Mm-hmm.
And these were things we were able to watch on live television, you know. Mm. I remember sitting in front of the TV in February 1990, and there was just a camera, and we were waiting for this, again, this figure who we'd grown up knowing in one context, that of a prisoner, mm-hmm. was about to walk out and be a free man. And that was amazing. So, I mean, I think it was forgivable to think that maybe there was some end of history vibes going on and things were actually going to be much more chill. And look, here we are in 2022 and shit's quite fucked.
Mm. Now, you've got another song lined up. Should we crack straight into another song?
Okay.
You've got Soul to Soul.
Yeah.
Back to Life here.
This was so much... So much the sound of hey Jen. So much the sound of London in 1989. The Soul to Soul Collective. I remember going to see them at the Brixton Academy, and you really felt part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we lived in Brixton, and you kind of felt part of what they were doing. And yeah,
I've got some questions to ask off here. Let's hit this tune.
Back to life, back to reality, back to life. Back to reality.
Hurry, mommy. Hurry, leave me. How?
Soul to Soul, Back to Life, selected by Russell Brown. In here, talking about Straitjacket Fits in Berlin, A Voyage to the Pointy End, an article up on audioculture.co.nz. Now, Russell, I had a question regarding Flying Nun and, I guess, global awareness of Flying Nun, which had been around since 81, but I guess word probably spread a bit slower before the internet. Was there an awareness of Flying Nun and their output of music both in the UK and the US around the time that Straitjacket Fits were breaking through?
Yeah, the US, it was mostly distribution deals. Where actually New Zealand music, well, where Flying Nun hit first, and the same thing happened years later for the likes of Fat Freddy's Drop, was Germany. And Flying Nun was distributed by this strange German label that really loved the music, but it wasn't like anything else they did, called Normal.
Okay.
And I can recall about a year after I landed in London, so it would have been maybe 87, Flying Nun UK was set up by Craig Taylor, who was the Chills manager, who was a New Zealander. He's back here now, lives in Wellington, who'd been working with the Thompson Twins. So there was a New Zealand connection there as well. Flying Nun was getting a reasonable amount of attention, especially with the Chills based there. You know, the Chills are another one of these stories that almost got there. You know, they were I think they were record of the week on Radio 1, and then they just missed out on being on Top of the Pops. And at one point, I'm sure Martin won't mind me saying this, they were offered an Andrew Weatherall remix.
Oh, wow.
At the time where that was awesome. Gold. And Marty decided, and, you know, all power to him. He said, that's not really what our music's about. So thanks, but no thanks.
Well, my jaw is on the floor in here.
Yeah.
Well, in hindsight, I mean, obviously, that's, you know.
Yeah, I always thought the one that the Flying Nun track that would have been glorious to hear a Weatherall remix of is the Clean's Point That Thing.
Oh, yep.
Because it's a groove, you know. That would have been amazing. So,
now, did you manage to catch Straitjacket Fits a couple of times throughout Europe?
Yeah, I did. I saw them a couple of times in London and hung out with them a bit because, you know, when your friends and bands come over, you hang out with them. Yeah, that was kind of basically how it worked. Bands would land and they'd be billeted out to the houses of helpful countrymen, basically.
Yep. You know.
And that was neat when it happened. Yeah.
Do you have a favourite era of Straitjacket Fits, Dimmer and so forth?
Oh, God. So that's quite a perilous question. You could get me into trouble, but probably
Shane
actually,
Carter is probably listening.
Probably actually the first album, Hail. I think that's the one because you had the balance between, you know, Shane's rock and roll fire and Andrew Bruff's melodic sparkle, and yeah, probably then. I mean, although I have to say it was quite a mystery to me what they were like when they arrived, because I'd heard the records, but living in London, of course, I hadn't seen them, you know, and I was used to, you know, going down to the Windsor Castle and seeing bands. So that was interesting seeing them, and I had no idea what this was going to be like live, and it, you know, turned out it was extremely fully formed and great.
Incredibly compelling.
Yeah.
No doubt.
It was, yeah. Because I think the last time I'd seen Shane live on stage was with the Double Happies.
Nice one. All right, shall we play this Straitjacket Fits tune? What is it and why have you chosen it?
I think I chose Sparkle That Shines, didn't I?
Yes.
Because this, yeah, Andrew Bruff, I think it was even evident on that tour that he struggled a bit with the touring life, and for all their, you know, infamous 1991 press conference where they're, oh, yay, no more slow songs, I think it was much more a matter of he didn't deal that well with band life, with international band life and the touring. And this was the last, you know, was about a little over a year later they announced he was leaving, but I think the die was cast before that. So it had been a very long, long tour, and I think that was telling on him. You know, and he still went on and wrote, you know, a few more beautiful songs. But some
incredible bike records.
Yeah, the bike records. Mm. You know, as beloved on Australian soap operas. Mm. Whoever was commissioning the music at Grundy really, really loved Andrew Brough's songs. He made actually quite a lot of money, more money than anyone else in the band, because his, you know, all his songs were licensed to Grundy Soaps. He bought a house off it.
Nice.
Yeah, and he deserved to as well. They worked beautifully in that context. Yeah. So,
awesome. Russell, thank you very much for coming in this evening. If anyone wants to check it out, head to audiococktail.co.nz. Straightjacket Fits in Berlin, a voyage to the pointy end, an article that you wrote for Rip It Up. In 1989.
Yes, yeah. And I have no idea how it was done without the internet. But yeah, go to Audio Culture. It's a wonderful site. There's just, I mean, you've heard me tell some stories. There's just stories galore. It's what the site's about. Cheers, Johnny. Thank
Legend.
You.
Thank you, mate.
We feel
was
Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just fascinating.